Well, we're grateful for the presence of everyone today, this beautiful Lord's Day. Appreciate everybody being here today. The lesson is entitled, More Fools Than Ever. I noticed in one of those songs that Seth just led, the word fool appeared. I would be fool to give up. We are foolish sometimes. The Bible uses the word fool or foolish several times. We're taught not to individually call a person that, you know. We have to use better language than that. But still, the concept is there, and God calls us that. And we can, in principle, refer to us as that, as being foolish or as being a fool. In Psalm 14:1, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, the writer says. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They're all gone aside. They're all together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge? Who eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord? There were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. Ye have shamed the counsel of the poor, because the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion, when the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people. Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall be glad. You'll notice that in this psalm, the psalmist, when he's referring to no one's doing right, no one's doing good, and all this, these are the enemies of God's people. Now the people seem to be in captivity for having rejected God in practice in days gone by, and they had gone off into idolatry. But Paul will refer to this in Romans 3 in a more general way to everybody, regarding Jews and Gentiles. So it's a sad thing. Corruption follows when you think this. He doesn't say they say it, but he says they think it. They say it in their hearts. There is no God. They become abominable. They don't do good. That's what follows from all of this. I want us to think about some things this morning. When I think about this idea of more fools than ever, I'm doing this because of a recent Gallup poll. It really surprises me in a way that things are, I thought they would be worse than they really are, at least in concept. Charles Pugh put this on the Warren website the other day, and it says, belief in God in U.S. dips to 81%. Now, it surprises me that it's still that high, but it dips to 81%, a new low. And I'll read just part of this. Gallup's May the 2nd, this year's poll says, values and beliefs poll finds 17% of Americans say they do not believe in God. 17%. Gallup first asked this question in 1944, repeating it again in 47, and twice each in the 50s and 60s. In those latter four surveys, a consistent 98% said they believed in God. I think I grew up in those days. When Gallup asked the question nearly five decades later in 2011, 92% of Americans said they believed in God, still pretty high. And then in 2013, it dipped to below 90 to 87%, roughly where it stood in three subsequent updates between 14 and 17, before this year's drop to 81%. Gallup has also in recent years asked other questions aimed at measuring belief in God or a higher power, all find the vast majority of Americans saying they believe. When given the option, 5% to 10% have said they were unsure. younger liberal Americans least likely to believe in God? The younger liberal Americans. Belief in God has fallen the most in recent years among young adults and people on the left of the political spectrum, liberals and Democrats. These groups show drops of 10 or more percentage points comparing the 2022 figures to the 13 to 17 polls. The groups with the largest declines are also the groups that are currently least likely to believe in God, including liberals, young adults, and Democrats. Belief in God is highest among political conservatives and Republicans. But then of those who say they believe in God, four in ten say that God intervenes or answers prayer. Four in ten. That means six out of the ten of the group that say they believe in God do not think that God is answering our prayer. About half of those who believe in God, equal to 42% of all Americans, say God hears prayers and can intervene on a person's behalf. Meanwhile, 28% of all Americans say God hears prayers but cannot intervene. And 11% think he doesn't do either. 30% of young adults believe God hears prayers and can intervene. Well, that's encouraging. But let me get to the last part of this. Fewer Americans today than 5 years ago believe in God. And the percentage is down even more from the 50s and 60s when almost all Americans did. Still, the vast majority of Americans believe in God, whether that means they believe in a higher power that hears prayers or and can intervene or not. And while belief in God has declined in recent years, Gallup has documented steeper drops in church attendance, church membership, and confidence in organized religion, suggesting that the practice of religious faith may be changing more than basic faith in God. That last part is insightful in a way. You know, denominationalism has never really worked in America, and we've had a country long enough for generation after generation to analyze the situation, and more people have seen through the contradictions of denominationalism. Then we got into the community church kind of thing, and we're still there. People wanting independent groups because they saw what Methodism was and what the Baptist church was, and they think they've seen what the Church of Christ was, and maybe what it was in some places, just another kind of denomination. And so they want God, but they don't want formality. They don't want to be in an official credential church because look at the history of the churches in America. If people had only come to a knowledge of the truth, why must it be so hard? Because of the will, again. But we live in the circumstance. Israel had to live in the with the nations as they were, not as Israel designed them. And we have to live in the America that is here, not as we had hoped, but that has developed. And so we pray for a better day. I hope you are. I'm hoping God will allow us to live long enough to see a better day, a better citizenry, and certainly a better government that will help the citizens by policies that are in harmony with God's will. I want to think then about the existence of God this morning, a very basic lesson in a way, cover several points. But we have more fools than ever. And it is surprising to me that we don't have more than we do, given the humanistic effort of the last 40 years to try to turn the American populace into humanism and into humanists, away from religion as such. But the concept of God is open to evidence and proof, and it's been here ever since God has talked with man, and the heavens have been here. And you can't, as Brother Warren would tell us years and years ago, if there's one thing that exists, it's God. If one thing exists, it's either God or it's here because of God. It comes back to that finally. But our young people don't think through these things. And they listen to professors daily who hold religion in contempt. I can understand that to a point. And they think that there's no God because look at what the religious people do. And look at what their doctrines are. They don't even make sense. And so you can be more loving and kind and liberal if you just opt for no religion, or at least a religion that doesn't put as many people in hell. And hell deserves a lot more thought from our generation than what it's been given. But it's sad to think of the psychological status of the American condition right now. Think of where America is. In light of the obvious existence of God because of myself, because of himself and herself, because of the heavens, because of the Bible. You know, in the 1200s, that's almost 1,000 years ago, Thomas Aquinas came out with what had traditionally, in the history of thought, been referred to as his five ways, the five ways. Thomas Aquinas is a much respected theologian in Catholic tradition. You'll find their schools or colleges named after Thomas Aquinas, and they'll have a philosophical tradition. Are you a Thomist or not? When I was at a Catholic university years ago, the head of the philosophy department was not a Thomist, but the head of the theological department was. And so they were at odds. And so the philosopher finally lost out, had to go somewhere. And he was one of the sharpest philosophers. That, of course, I've been around just a few, but I'm telling you, he was incredible. And he attended the war and flu debate. Joseph Cypher, but he lost out with the Thomists. And so he got the Pope's blessing, started his own school. And Dick Staniel, who had been with me at the University of Dallas, and David Life and Jim Laws, he got to study with him at his own school for a little while. But he was not a Thomist. But I'm telling you, though you might not be a Thomist, he was a brilliant man. And in the 1200s, 1,000 years ago, he came up with what have been referred to as his five ways. And I just want to read them. We're not going to discuss them. But he had a proof of God that it's a proof from motion, from actuality and potentiality. You have to start with something in movement. And so that was on motion. The second one had to do with the argument from efficient cause. And the third one was from the possibility and necessity. The fourth one was you argue from the degrees or the gradation of things found in things. And the fifth way was the governance of the world, how things seem to be designed in nature. And if that's so, then there has to be something beyond nature that's doing that. And anyway, it's been a powerful set of arguments for the existence of God over the years. We usually pick it up with the idea of the cosmological argument, and a lot of that has to do with this, and the teleological argument. Psalm 19:1 is a cosmological proposition. The heavens declare the glory of God. How do I know God is there? Because the heavens are. Man, look up. See your universe for what it is. Now, you can't go from the first century. You can't go from the time of Adam. You can't go from the 21st century with any kind of innocence for not seeing that evidence. It's not a matter of being allowed to live to the 21st century. We've had people on the earth that have finally decided Anthony Flew was one. God exists because I now see DNA evidence. We now have evidence that is available and that is conclusive. So I know God exists. And even when Flew did that, though he opted for what he thought was probably true, Christianity, he did not become a believer in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, nor Christianity as the religion of God. He came to be a believer in God, and that's where he was stuck. His daddy was a Methodist preacher, and he had a son like Anthony Flew. through all of his adult years, almost all of them, fought Christianity. And look at Europe now, where he lived, where he was. Look at Europe now. And now look at America now. He was one of the world-renowned atheists during his life. And when Brother Warren got to debate him in Denton, that was a world event. And I was there every night. Man, what a debate. What a situation in the providence of God was brought about. Because there's one of God's children on the earth that's willing to stand up for the truth and to meet a force that is a force to be reckoned with in the world that is denouncing God. It was a most remarkable thing. But anyway, you have the cosmological, you got the teleological, Acts 14:17. At Lystra, a Gentile community, Paul says, God didn't give you a Bible, but he gave you witness. He gave you fruitful seasons. He filled your hearts with food and gladness. He gave you the cycles of the seasons. See, that's you're into not just cosmological, but the design of things. Do you have a crop? Are you able to eat? Why is that? Why are things able to grow and develop? We plant and we harvest. How is that possible? In a Greek community as well as a Jewish one, God gave you that. That can't happen by fluke. There's not an evolutionary sub-theory in the world that can explain a thing like that. And then there's the moral argument that goes back to conscience. And you start toying around with that and denying that, you're denying objective ethics. There is no objective right and there is no objective wrong. And that makes the world ever more dangerous. Ever more dangerous. There is no objective standard of right and wrong. You create chaos on the earth with a view like that. And then there's the Bible itself. Brother Warren told Dr. Plew, if you're willing to debate on the Bible, we'll come over there to England and have a debate on that. But this debate is about God. About the existence of God. There's no question about His existence. And there's no question about the facts of the gross immorality of our nation. What does God think of us? Well, you've got the principles in Scripture. What do you think about Israel? What do you think about Sodom and Gomorrah? How long will He let us go in our current degenerated condition? But some of our leaders are pathetically corrupt. If not in life, at least in concept. And some it may be in life. But at any rate. Now let's come to the matter of practice. You know, you don't have to say in your heart there is no God in a formal way. And you don't have to be a philosopher and write out a critique of God and deny God in a formal way. You can just live like there's no God and not give it much thought. Now, a lot of people live like there's no God. And there is no accountability. There's no reckoning. And that makes a dangerous world. More and more of Americans live like that. And so it's the concept is attacked directly in formal argument, but indirectly by bad practice. In the 1700s, there was a Catholic priest by the name of La Mettrie, M-E-T-T-R-I-E, La L-A Mettrie. His life was a fraud, as it turned out. You didn't know that till it was about, he's gone. But his entire life almost was a fraud. Well, how did that work? Well, he became a priest. But when he was near death, he wrote out a document that fueled the fires of unbelief after he passed. And he gave up God. He had given up God years and years and years and years ago. I'm not saying he was an atheist, but he said, whether you believe in God or whether you don't believe in God, it doesn't matter. Well, the Bible says it does, but he had given up the Bible too. He had no use for the Bible. He thought if more priests read the Bible, they'd give it up. That's how awful his thinking was. He said he became a priest because he obeyed his parents. Well, you know, if you live in a world and a society where Catholicism dominates and where that's the thing and that's the power and the church has a lot of the wealth, would you steer your son into the priesthood? I'm just asking. So he wanted to please his parents, so he became a priest. But early on, in his mind, he threw it all out. But he went on with the hypocrisy of it, as he saw it, I guess. He lived a hypocritical life. We don't usually get an objective and honest and candid statement from a dying person or from one getting close to death. We just don't do that. But boy, he laid it out. And he didn't trust God. He didn't trust the Bible. And he was calling on everybody else out there. Of course, in his day, you had to toe the line. You had to be careful. Because, you know, there are kings that can take your life. And there's the church that can take your life. Imagine living in a world where you're under pressure to be careful. And when the philosophers came about, like Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, and people like that, they hated the Catholic clergy. But you have to be careful. Hey, say things. You can die for this. Now we, of course, a lot of times think about the bravery involved in the Reformation. Lutherans, Zwinglian, Huss, people like that. And rightly we do. But imagine just living in a society where danger's on every hand. If you put what you really think down on paper and send it out. Well, you have these philosophers now that are coming along, you know, and feeling their way, and there is more freedom now in the 1700s than there has been, but you still have to be very, very careful. You don't want to make the king mad, or you don't want to make the pope necessarily mad. And so you have to be as honest as you think you can be in a circumstance that you don't like, and you wish it were other than it was. And some of these philosophers began to work on a set of encyclopedias. You ever, when you were young, did your daddy get you some World Book encyclopedias or Encyclopedia Britannica or something like that? And we're talking about the 1700s. And these fellas are going to put out a set of books that's going to be the summation, you know, of the culmination of knowledge down to that point in time as best they can. Quite an undertaking. And it was something, but it was also parts of it were controversial, and they had to watch what they said and maybe edit something or take something back. But it was something else. And had you been in that war? If you've been alive, and you've got what these philosophies, who are basically deists or atheists, writing these books, or you have the Catholic clergy, who would you support? Where would your vote go? You say, "Why? I'm for these more than these, or I'm for these more than these." Mine would go with the philosophies. I hate tortured religious power that itself becomes a torturer. I hate false philosophy. They said a lot of things that were wrong and some things that were good. But they had the idea man does not just bow down to a... And if this is the apostate church, these guys over here don't credit these priests with being men of God. And if you read about how some of them lived and how some of the popes lived, you'd say the same thing. So you've either got over here on the one hand, now you've got people that are involved in the the Reformation trying to stay afloat and trying to come ahead and come on. But then you've got this monstrous, dominating Catholic Church, and you've got these people that are just believe that God is up there, but He doesn't do anything down here, or they've given up God altogether, writing books. And it's going to affect the world. What a world to live in. I don't know how to be grateful enough that I could live in the world of America in the 20th century and then on into the 21st in a culture that at least was still paying lip service to God and allowing us the freedom to worship like we are today. Monday's the 4th of July. All over this country, there will be people having cookouts and thinking about the revolution in our country and all of that. And some of them, many of them, will be thankful to God. And some of them won't give God a thought. And some of them right now are trying to destroy all that we've been because they think that has been misguided. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 18, Moses said, "And thou shalt do right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest go in and possess the good land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers." Now notice this. In Deuteronomy 12, 8, he said, "Ye shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes." He says, you don't want to live like that. You don't want to be like that. And in Judges 21, 25, later, Joshua told us, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, let me just make a comment or two about history at large. When I'm thinking about God, and so many people, early on in life, you know, people gave up God for idols. They created the gods. Israel stayed with her God most of the time. Sometimes she didn't. God existed before creation. Genesis 1:1, Psalm 9 in verse 2. "Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God." What a concept. Can your mind wrap itself around it? Not exactly. But from everlasting, there's no beginning. To everlasting, there's no end. Thou art God. That's what he meant when he told Moses, "You tell those people down there, I am. What a description of God. So, how does God keep the Gentiles oriented toward Him without a Bible? By their conscience. A moral law. What does He do for the Jew? He not only gives them conscience, He gives them a creed. As a whole, the Gentiles surrendered their conscience, Romans 1, and a lot of times the Jews neglected their creed. And in 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 5 and verse 20, we get insight into the fact that they wanted to be like the world. Would you have been a faithful Jew in that covenant period? So many of them didn't like their circumstance. They didn't like being a minority. They didn't like being different from everybody else. "Make us a king to go before us, to fight our battles for us. We want to be like the nations round about us." And you know what caused that to come to the fore? It was the corruption of Samuel's sons. Now these are supposed to be religious boys. Religious boys. They're supposed to be practicing the authorized religion for the Jews. And the reaction to that, when they corrupted themselves, was calling for something that would further enable the Jews to be like the nations round about them. Which is worse? A corrupt heart that's religious? A corrupt heart that is anti-religious? Which is worse? I think the religious corrupt heart is worse, because it starts doing things, even though it's corrupt, if it's still religious, he tries to offer corrupt service to God. And if he persecutes you, he thinks he's doing it to the glory of God. I find that the higher stimulus, rather than an atheist or communist that might kill you because you're not worth anything. But over here, well, he's offering service to God. He thinks he's got a higher calling than this man does. I say that man's more dangerous than that man is. The clash between religion and non-religion, belief in God and no belief in God. In the history of the world, how much unbelief has been the result of either an alleged Christian who was not one at all or a Christian who was corrupt? How many criticisms have been offered against local churches of Christ over the history of your life because of corrupt Christians? And how much of it did you never hear, but that was spoken? Corruption inside the church stymies truth. There are things that hinder the practice of truth. I ask myself, am I hindering or helping truth right now as I live on this earth? 2 Timothy 2:16 through 18, there are those who hinder the truth by the way that they live. Doesn't have to be a formal argument. I don't believe in God anymore. I'm giving up on Christ. I'm giving up on the Bible. Just live in a rotten way, or a way that compromises the truth. The truth is hindered, Paul said, in unrighteousness. How many people will lose their souls because of that? Psalm 10 and verse 4, the psalmist said, the wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. Or the American Standard says, all his thoughts are, there is no God. Paul predicted massive apostasy in Acts 20, 28 through 31, which led to corruption in morals, and it led to corruption and abuse of power. It's horrible to think about that. Such apostasy finally resulted in reaction in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And I'm glad that a Renaissance as such finally came. In his series of books called The Story of Civilization, I want you to listen to this quotation I'm taking from Will Durant. Talking about the 1700s. The debate that agitated the intellectual classes in the half century before the Revolution was not quite a conflict between religion and philosophy. It was primarily a conflict between the philosophies and Catholic Christianity as it existed at the time in France. You see, today when people in America decide, I don't want Christianity, what they are usually rejecting is not the church of which you are a part, but it's what they've known, what they have experienced in their community or their state, and they don't like what they've seen. And that's what was going on with Catholicism. See, people thought that's the church that you read about in the Bible. Why, they can trace that thing all the way back to the popery of Peter, even though that was a lie. But that's what they were reacting to. And right now in America, when people don't want formal religion, they don't want you to have to come to a building and worship. They don't want any kind of organization, and they might say rules and regulations. It's got to be purely private. Well, you can't have congregational Christianity as God intended that way. But they've seen what the congregations do, and they've seen the doctrinal contradictions between congregations who meet, and so they can use their minds and say, well, that can't be right. And so they throw it all away, including the church for which Jesus died. It's another overreaction. We're good at things like that. Let me mention this point. Formal attacks against God's existence have come from two sources, philosophy and science. I tell you what was done in the Warren flu debate, and I've written this down. It's in print. Brother Warren helped the church far more than he ever helped the world, because he taught us that truth can always overwhelm and defeat error. When truth is in the hands of a competent believer, and the devil brings full force, all that the world can give against truth, you see this error fall. That's what you saw in four nights in Denton, Texas. In fact, you saw it starting to crumble the first night of the discussion. And then it got worse every other night. Got worse and worse and worse. And years passed after that debate, and finally, Flew gave up his atheism. He never credited Warren with it. He should have given him more credit, because he later wrote about that debate. But he never gave him the credit that he deserved. But anyway, false philosophy brings its attack against. And then science. How many children in America are now evolutionists? Because in public schools, they know Darwin's name more than they know God's. And in zoo exhibits, and they line up, you know, the primates and the orangutans and the gorillas, and they get us all the way up to the Homo sapien, and there's man. And how many little kids go every year and see those exhibits, and they're taught about all these things and how it works, as though it's like that? What a bunch of nonsense. The devil is helping to destroy our country by stupidity like that. Because there are times when the world wants stupidity, and it intends to have it. And it won't let truth get in the way. When Brother Warren presented his chart with the flu, now look, it comes down to either creation or evolution. If it's creation, that implies God. If it's evolution implies it's by birth or transformation. If it's not birth and it's not transformation, it's not evolution. If it's not evolution, it's creation. If it's creation, it implies God. And he said to the audience, there is the proof for the existence of God right before your face. How could he do that? How could he say that? And how could Flew not overcome that? Because Flew knew evolution implies birth or transformation, and there is no proof of transformation. And there is no proof of birth, one non-human giving birth to a human. And if there's no evidence by birth and no evidence by transformation, there's no evidence of evolution. And for years the world had been taught, we know this is so. There is no God behind the universe. And just in a few words, Brother Warren took it all away. From Flew and from every philosopher and every scientist in the world. It was a most amazing thing. He never recovered from what Brother Warren did to him, and yet he didn't lose respect for him. He recommended him for some honor later on. Because the flu at that time, it's just all part of an academic, I don't know if you call it game or what, but you know, you honor people with sense and mentality, and that's the way he looked at it. It wasn't until several years passed he finally decided. As he told us up there, he always tried to follow the route that truth led. I'll pursue truth wherever it takes me. That's what he said there, that was his view. And he finally had to admit, it doesn't go to atheism. Somebody has designed all of this. Well, it was about time. I'm about to get to the end of this, but let me mention these points. Bad reason can be used to support false religion, just like it can to be used to support false philosophy. and it has historically. But the Bible still calls on all of us, prove all things. It calls us to intellectual competence and honesty. Prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. But there have been and there are historical periods in which many people give up on God. They don't want God. They don't want proof of God. It doesn't matter that you can prove God. They're not going to submit to it. They don't want it. They don't want the world to be like that. They don't want reality to be like that. Romans 1 verses 23 and 28. Those passages show us that historically. And this means that there are times when evil, now listen to this, evil cannot at the moment be massively overcome in a society even by good, because reason is not welcome. And it seems to me that that's about where the American culture is, at least in those that dominate. In the wills and minds of those that dominate the policies and the thinking of this culture. There are times when evil cannot be overcome by good because right reason is not welcome. But and yet, you know, Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3, 1 and 2, he wanted the Thessalonians to pray for him that he might be delivered from unreasonable men. He said, for all have not prayed. It is unreasonable to look at the evidence for God and Christ and the Bible and the church and to turn it all down. It's unreasonable. But there is a time, like before the flood, when Noah preached, did any newspaper report 400 people were converted by Brother Noah today? Out in the wilderness, it went so well, my goodness, 1,000 people repented. Nobody outside of his family understood or welcomed the truth. It wasn't welcome out there by Noah, one of the greatest men that's ever been on the earth. Noah, Daniel, and Job. Think about Sodom and Gomorrah. Was the truth welcomed in Sodom when the angels came there or before? No. What about the period of the judges in which the Israel itself was sputtering around in the quagmire of its own evil for over 300 years? Then what about the Assyrian captivity? What preceded that when the prophets spoke to them? Was it welcome? No. What about the Babylonian captivity? Did Judah learn to listen to the prophets? No. What about the intertestamental period? When Antiochus Epiphanes offered a sow on the altar outside the temple. A lot of people, whether you're in the citizenry, you're part of the government, you're part of an apostate church, you don't want reason. You don't welcome it. You want something else more than truth. And then there's the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus predicted it, talked about it. Matthew 23, Matthew 24, it's coming. It came about 40 years after he went back to heaven. Did the Jews, as a nation, want the truth? We've been talking in Romans 11, in our Bible class period, what happened with the Jews in the gospel. And Jesus, follow the line. And Jesus said to those Jews, your house shall be left unto you desolate. And 40 years later, the house came tumbling down as a nation of the covenant people of God. Well, we've got to be fearless and faithful and strong. We must not despair. We want to be good. We want to be faithful. We want to be righteous. It's not a matter of numbers. It's not a matter of when you come into the picture. It's a matter of just wanting to be right, wanting to do right, wanting to go to heaven, wanting to serve God, wanting to be a blessing to my neighbor. Loving God and loving neighbor. Sometimes puzzle over what happens when a man loves God, but he doesn't love his brother. John would say, you know, if you love God, you ought to love your brother. You've not seen God, you've seen your brother. Now, what about those kinds of things? What about when a man loves God but doesn't love his neighbor? Or he says, I love my neighbor, but he doesn't love God. What are the complexities of those kinds of things? Jesus taught, as Brother Warren pointed out in his dissertation, you cannot be the best son without being the best neighbor. You can't be the best son of God without being the best neighbor to your fellow man. That's the church. That's the church. Loving God. That's what we have to do. And we should want to be that way. So when our time comes, and it's not far off, we'll be prepared. Having loved God and having loved neighbor. Life is something. It's such a challenge. And it's such a blessing. May God help us to love His truth, to love His church, to love Him, to love the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Be right with God every day. So if any given day is the day that we leave, we are most ready to go. May God be praised and His will be exhibited by His church on this earth. If you're here this morning and not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, we encourage you to come back right now while together we stand, while we sing. Won't you come?